I now give you to speak on the jurisprudence of judicial restraint, Judge Clifford Wallace.
I was interested with, through the miracle of modern science, how much cooler it is this afternoon than it was this morning. When I went on the bench in 1970, I was a district court judge for some 18 months, and we had a small courtroom that got very warm in the afternoon, and I told the jurors, initially, if I saw any heads bowing, I would signal the bailiff, and down would go the air conditioning. And in these times after heavy lunches, you see that would happen quite often with 12 given people in there. My room, courtroom, became known as a very cold courtroom. The bailiff asked a minister's wife one day what she thought of serving in my courtroom, and she says, "Well, many are cold, but few are frozen." I'm going to sketch briefly and very briefly something it should take a seminar to go over, and that is my thoughts on the jurisprudence of judicial restraint. I'm going to skip over my thoughts about original intent, interpretism, and non-interpretism, and just join as common ground what Bob Bork said last night. I was interested that we now have originalists and non-originalists as another way of describing what's going on. But I, for one, am one that looks to the original intent. And I believe it, and I believe it for the words that were stated by Judge Bork last night. And I don't propose to proceed along that issue because today it's a little different. The topic is a little different, the scope and character of judicial review. Actually, the answer to this question largely depends upon your perception of the role of courts in society. That is, what role should courts have in the system of governance? Should the courts attempt to find some ultimate moral value that society is to live by? Should the courts be involved in re-engineering society? When legislatures move too slow, should we look to the courts to answer more promptly some of the critical issues that are before us? Now, the theory I espouse, that is, the jurisprudence of judicial restraint, is based upon a very simple political doctrine, that is, the separation of powers. William O. Douglas said that no one knows their judicial philosophy until they've been on the bench 5 years. And I think that's probably true. There have been many disappointed presidents who found that to be true. But after 5 years, and I began to think through why it is I believe what I believe, it boiled down to my basic feeling as to what the three branches should be doing as they interact in governance. It is my view that social policy should be developed by the legislature. As you might guess, I have far greater faith in the legislature than Henry Manning does. I have a belief that we have elected representatives for a purpose, and I believe in the democratic process. And so I have a tendency to put more of my faith and confidence, at least from a jurisdictional point of view, in those whom we elect and whom we can run out than I do in the courts that have lifetime tenure. The role of the courts, as I see it, is limited essentially to our constitutional pronouncements, and that those constitutional as well as statutory pronouncements should be interpreted by the writer's intent. Now, I think maybe that many of you will agree with this, but I think you will agree with it more strongly depending upon how you view the democratic process. Thus, my theory of judicial restraint is one of judicial respect. That is, that the judiciary should respect the other two co-equal branches. It restrains the judiciary to function in its limited role. Now, too often, we've been told that those who believe in judicial restraint are analogous to a person riding with their foot on the brake, trying to keep society from moving forward. I suggest to you this is a false analogy. What judicial restraint really means is that we would restrain the judiciary so that the democratic process can be more dynamic. That is, it is only through the dynamic process of democracy, where people are together and exercising their right to vote for people and have the interest enough to control their legislatures, that true freedom can be achieved and where we can really progress as a free society. Once we allow the judiciary to have its incursions upon this democratic process, we're not riding with our foot on the brake. we're indeed defeating the very process we're trying to stimulate. So properly applied, I suggest to you, it doesn't matter whether a court is liberal or whether it's conservative. It should be exercising judicial restraint. And so I would take issue, I suppose, with Henry's comment that principle doesn't transcend interest. That is, that people should be and will be result-oriented, and that the principle doesn't matter. I want to argue to you the principle does matter, that it's indispensable in a free society, and that we cannot be result-oriented, depending upon whether we have the particular nine at that time or whether the other side does. And so I put the question to you. Should conservatives adhere to the theory of judicial restraint after liberal activism? James Buchanan, just last week, gave an interesting lecture in San Diego, and I attended it. As you know, he was the 1986 Nobel Peace Prize winner, economics winner, for his application of the economic theories in political choice. His theory is that you don't throw the rascals out, you change the principle. That is, he would say it's much less important who you appoint to the court, even the Supreme Court, than it is that you develop a philosophy that people will follow. That is, the rule is important. The application would be that those that are interested in the federal courts and what they are doing in law should be interested in developing the type of rules that would govern people rather than making changes one by one of judges. Now, how does he design his rule? He uses what he refers to as a veil of ignorance model. And the veil of ignorance model is you take a step back and you're ignorant of how it's going to come out. And then you develop your rule, not knowing the outcome. What will be a fair rule to devise? And he uses the analogy of playing cards. That is, when four people sit down to play a game of cards, before the cards are dealt and you know what cards you have in your hand, you decide what the rules of the game are. So that is entirely not result-oriented, but entirely free from result orientation. Well, that results, he says, in the choice of a rule which will ultimately be made that will be closer to the public good and will maximize public good. Now, I suggest to you that you can apply James Buchanan's theory into the area of the judiciary. And it comes out, as I view it, with a theory of judicial restraint, which is a principle that opposes activism in either direction. It is not result-oriented. It consistently leaves the societal decisions to those who must return to be elected. It enhances the democratic process. It provides for stability and for consistency in law. It provides the greatest amount of liberty under law. And that's why I adhere to a jurisprudence of judicial restraint. Now, one question will obviously come up. Can activist precedent ever be overturned? That is, as you have times where judicial activists have gone on their intrusions into the area and have not exercised judicial restraint. When can you turn them over? As a part of my jurisprudence of judicial restraint, there must be a respect for certain values, the values of precedent, the values of uniformity of decision. People generally must be able to rely on the law, and to be able to rely on the law, it has to have a consistency, and that consistency demands precedent respect. But there must be times when those values can be overcome. When, as a principled matter, can you overcome those values? Left unchecked, periodic activist inroads could emasculate fundamental doctrines and undermine the separation of powers. In these instances, it seems to me that change is appropriate. Not change from my level. When I'm on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, my role is clear. I follow the law of the Supreme Court and the rules of my own circuit. It's one of my brothers on the circuit says, sometimes you have to hold your nose when you're right, but you're right, because we're bound by precedent. Not so much so by the Supreme Court, who have the ultimate view. With them, they can take a close look and see if that precedent still is what is necessary in order to develop and maintain the fundamental underlying doctrines of the Constitution. I noticed that Attorney General Meese said there are times when these can be overturned. He used the term not often and the term not casually. In trying to wrestle with this problem, what I tried to do is develop an intellectually sound basis of when these periodic activists' inroads can be overturned. I suggest the following three guides. First, that the decision is clearly wrong. Second, that it has important effects. And third, it would otherwise be difficult to negate. If these three criteria are met, then I suggest there's time, what General Meese said today, not often, not casually, but by matter of principle, precedent can be overturned. Why? Because that precedent interferes with fundamental constitutional doctrines and primarily in the separation of powers, which by my light is what makes the entire system of governance function appropriately. Well, I've run through very rapidly my view of judicial restraint. As I say, it's one that's based upon, as I see it, a neutral principle that is not result-oriented, but it's one in which will hold the judiciary intact, as it should be held intact, during the process of governance. Let me just state, as I stated once before, a summary of that view. A consequence of judicial restraint is that courts will not be able to right every wrong, even every genuine wrong. We can take consolation in the abilities of the states and the other branches of the federal government to handle many of the evils that are beyond the proper reach of the courts. It is true that they may fail, and if they continue to do so, some wrongs may never be righted. Some may ascribe this to the human condition. But if it occurs, it is the price we must pay for a system that does a better job overall of preserving our fundamental values than would be a system making use of judicial activism's quick fix. In the long run, society will be the victor if fundamental constitutional values are preserved, even if the democratic deliberative process is sometimes slower than many would desire. On the eve of the Constitutional's bicentennial, we should remember that the moorings of that great document are sure and safe. Judicial restraint is a philosophy that most effectively preserves fundamental constitutional precepts. It encourages the separation of powers, protects our democratic process, and preserves our fundamental rights. It's for a return to these moorings that I plead.